This is the IBJ podcast for the week of December 14th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Let me take you back just for a second to early March 2020. On March 6th, Indiana health officials announced the first case of COVID-19 in the state. On March 11th, the World Health Organization declared the novel coronavirus outbreak a global pandemic. So Indiana lawmakers only had a vague idea of what lay ahead when on March 12th, they ended their 2020 legislative session. Now, when they reconvene on January 4th of next year, it will be their first opportunity as the full General Assembly to weigh in on all the ramifications of the pandemic in Indiana, with more than 425,000 cases recorded in the state and nearly 6,500 deaths. Now, to refresh your memory, state lawmakers meet every year for a legislative session, and every 2 years they make a budget for the state. This is one of those years, but this will be a session like few others. State tax revenue has fallen dramatically since the pandemic began and is expected to remain lower than would have otherwise been anticipated. That's due to the hamstrung economy and high unemployment. So lawmakers will have fewer dollars to work with as demand for state funds increases. That undoubtedly will lead to tough choices for lawmakers. IBJ's Lindsay Erdody covers state government for IBJ. I've asked her to give us a preview of the session and what likely will be legislators' top budget priorities. Here's our conversation. I am happy, as always, to welcome back to the IBJ podcast virtual studio, Lindsay Erdody, who covers state government for IBJ. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
So beginning on January the 4th, maybe January 4th, give or take, depending on what COVID-19 throws at us, the General Assembly will start its legislative and budget writing session, which is expected to go all the way to the end of April. So what is extraordinary about this budget writing session?
Yeah, so I don't think lawmakers would ever say that writing the budget is an easy task, but I think the pandemic is throwing some extra curveballs at them. You know, you think about the fact that lawmakers write the budget every 2 years. So they're predicting out 2 years in advance what the state's economy is going to look like. So they know roughly how much revenue the state's going to bring in. So they know roughly how much they can spend. You know, when they pass the budget we're under right now in 2019, I don't think anyone could have told you what April 2020 was going to look like. But that was something that they, you know, were trying to consider in that budget. What we saw happen with that budget was they ended up with a deficit of nearly $900 million just for fiscal year 2020. And that dropped our reserves down from about $2.3 billion to $1.4 billion. They were able to make some cuts in other areas and save some money that way. But, you know, revenue overall came in $1.4 billion less than projected, less than what they thought it was going to do when they passed that budget in 2019. So very different scenario. And so now lawmakers are coming in and trying to figure out what's 2022 going to look like? What is 2023 going to look like?
Where does the money come from? What are the sources of revenue for the state budget?
The majority of the budget comes from sales and income tax, just to, you know, put it as simply as I possibly can. There are a variety of other taxes in there. What is the economy going to be like? How much are people going to be spending? What's unemployment going to be like? And all of that's going to impact the state budget. And I think related to that is whether or not...
Be down.
Exactly.
Okay.
Congress passes more aid for states and local governments. You know, it's something some states, including Indiana, have called for along the way, but Congress seems reluctant to provide that, at least right now. And related to the economic recovery is how quickly the vaccine is rolled out and widely distributed. So there are several different kind of factors that we don't really know what's going to happen with yet that lawmakers are going to have to keep in mind as they're working on this budget, making it, I think, tougher than usual. The revenue forecast that is presented to the State Budget Committee is expected to come out on Wednesday, the 16th, and that will show us how much revenue the state expects to bring in over the next few years. And from that projection is kind of how lawmakers are going to start working on the budget.
So that's going to be a huge, huge bit of news. I mean, that's going to set the tone for the next several months.
Absolutely, yes. And then in April, they get a second revenue forecast, which just kind of gives them an update on where those numbers are. I mean, you'll have, you know, an extra 4 months of data and information to make those forecasts off of. And so that's something they do every time they're working on the budget. They get a forecast in December and in April. But it seems like next year, more than maybe in previous years, they really are going to be curious to see what that April forecast shows. Because from that, they'll make some tweaks to the budget. You know, they hope to have it mostly worked out at that point. But if it's a big change from the December forecast, then they're going to have to make big changes in the budget.
So we don't know what the forecast exactly is going to be. We're going to assume that's going to be challenging. So lawmakers are going to be looking for places in the state budget most likely to cut. Now, the biggest portion of the budget is K through 12 education, public education. In the most current budget, it is about 45% of the budget, huge chunk. Now, legislators have been under increasing pressure in recent years to increase K through 12 funding. What do schools and teachers, and presumably folks like me who have kids in the public education system, what do we want this money for?
People in the education system want to see, at the very minimum, funding remain flat. I think there will still be a push to increase funding. And we've heard from some top lawmakers, including Senate President Pro Tem Rod Bray, saying that he would like to give it an increase in the budget. But it's a matter of, is the money there for that? You know, some of the people in the education world that I've spoken to have said that staying flat, you know, it's just not going to be enough, because we were already having a teacher shortage in the state before the pandemic. And then the pandemic hit and schools saw more teachers retiring or leaving for various reasons. And they're struggling. And so the big topic during the 2019 budget was teacher pay and increasing teacher pay. And, you know, I think educators are going to come back this year and say, you know, this is an even bigger issue now.
Yeah, my recollection was, like, after that session, I mean, the funding increased by, I think, 2.5% for each year of the budget. But the teachers were saying, you know, that's nice, but we consider this to be a down payment, that we're coming back for more.
Absolutely. I think they were pleased to see increases. You know, certainly no one was complaining that they got an extra 2.5% every year. So they were happy about that. But I'm not sure anyone in the education world thought, oh, that's enough. That's plenty. You know, that's going to solve the problem. I think even lawmakers and the governor said that was a first step. That was a step in the right direction. But we saw the governor create the teacher pay commission to look into this more and how they could push even more funding towards education. And then, you know, like I said, the pandemic hit and it just kind of threw everything up into the air with that issue. But like I said, educators are still going to argue that that is a concern this year and that they do need more funding to pay teachers higher salaries.
So I guess we could play a game called, is it cuttable? Is the K through 12 education budget, politically speaking, is that cuttable? Is there a chance that funding could rise a bit, or should educators be happy that it's going to just stay the same?
So out of the top lawmakers and the budget writers that I spoke to, everyone said everything has to be on the table for discussions. But big caveat here, but education is going to be the last place they look to cut. So if K through 12 education is getting any sort of cut in the budget, then that means everything else is taking a cut in the budget.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ podcast. We're talking with IBJ reporter Lindsay Erdody about the upcoming Indiana legislative session and the pressures on the next budget. All right, now let's graduate, if you will, higher education. I thought of that just 10 seconds ago. Isn't that funny? I'm so good at this. Now, if we add higher education, the state's colleges and universities, now we're up to 62% of a current budget. But what kinds of budgetary pressure is higher ed, are the state colleges and universities under right now?
So higher ed already had to take a hit in the fiscal year 2021. So the budget we're currently operating under, they were asked to make cuts about 7% across the board as part of Holcomb's administration trying to make cuts knowing revenue was going to be coming in less than expected over this year. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with their budgets and the new budget that lawmakers are going to have to craft. But I think you're going to see higher education institutions coming in and saying, look, we already took a hit. You know, we tried to do our part and we need to get back to where we were and in the next budget.
Yeah, I would assume, you know, when you have, Mitch Daniels at Purdue University, when you have McRaby at Indiana University, who are just, you know, incredibly politically powerful, coming to you and letting you know what kind of challenges they have, the higher education would not necessarily be cuttable.
To lawmakers writing this budget, everything has to be on the table, but education, and I think that includes higher education to an extent. I think K through 12 is the top priority, but I think higher education is certainly another high priority on that list of making sure there's not cuts, because it all ties into making sure the state has educated individuals and educated people who can join the workforce. And that has been a big concern for years. And I'm sure the university is, you know, are coming to budget writers and laying out all of their other budgetary challenges and making the case the best they can.
The next big item in the budget is Medicaid, the state's funding of Medicaid. That takes us up to 73% of the budget now. What is the feeling about Medicaid dollars?
Medicaid is kind of out of lawmakers' control. It's a big chunk of the budget and they know it's going to be there every year. When we get the revenue forecast on Wednesday, there will also be a Medicaid forecast that will give lawmakers an idea of where that cost should be coming in at and what they can expect with that. But you're right, once you add education altogether and Medicaid, you're looking at less than a third of the budget that's available for cuts to really be made. And I think that's how a lot of lawmakers look at it, as you've got education and Medicaid over here, and that's a big chunk that we either can't touch or we're going to try really hard not to touch. And then we've got this little bit of the budget that we can start tweaking with.
We have this little bit of the budget for the rest of state government.
Yeah.
That we could perhaps tweak. Is there any conventional wisdom as to what might be, not necessarily the chopping block, but might have to prepare for some trims?
It's hard to say right now. I don't think anyone was willing to point out specific areas where, you know, they're really going to be looking to make cuts. You know, I will say I spoke to former Appropriations Chairman Luke Kenley, and one of his suggestions was looking at the Department of Child Services. And he admitted that that is probably not a popular suggestion, but his point was, is there a way to make that agency run more efficiently and do it with fewer dollars? And he referenced back to under Governor Mitch Daniels when they kind of restructured the BMV and were able to find efficiencies and cut some dollars. And so that's kind of how he was making that comparison in terms of lawmakers are going to, and Governor Holcomb is going to have to look at ways that things can be done more efficiently and hopefully better and with fewer dollars.
Can't legislators raise taxes if they need more money?
They absolutely can, but they will not. I asked about this several times, and there seems to be no appetite for this whatsoever. That would be an absolute last resort. The only tax that seems to be even remotely on the table is an increase to the cigarette tax, which is something that's been discussed for years at the State House. It's been Indiana Chamber of Commerce's priority for years at this point, with the argument that it would help reduce smoking rates in the state and improve overall health of Hoosiers. But the thing with the cigarette tax is no lawmaker is saying that that is going to help a budget hole. They're saying that that would be done for public health reasons, not for budgetary reasons, because if you think about it, the goal of the tax is to get fewer people to smoke. If fewer people are smoking, fewer people are buying cigarettes and paying that tax, so that tax revenue is going to go down. So you can't really count on that to always be there.
So right now, the reserve, which had been about $2.3 billion, which is a nice amount of money to have in your pocket, is $1.4 billion. I know that legislators are in love with reserves. I think we all are, if we look at our bank accounts. Is there a possibility that they will try to build that back up? They'll try to use some revenue to make that a bigger reserve again?
They would like to. They certainly don't think that they're going to be able to increase it back to the $2.3 billion that it was at. Not in this budget cycle, at least. But they would like to still have a strong reserve there. And the argument being, look, it helped us out in this last budget. So we need this because otherwise we would have been in big trouble, you know, because I think there has been some arguments over the years about how much is too much in the surplus, how much is not enough, whether or not they should have been spending that down earlier. And I think Republican lawmakers who for years have insisted on putting more money into the surplus are really going to point to this past year as their argument to continuing to put money into the surplus next year.
Let me quickly ask about the political makeup of the legislature. Speaking of Republicans, there wasn't a lot of shakeup after the November election. Republicans still control the legislature. They outnumber Democrats 71 to 29 in the House of Representatives, 39 to 11 in the Senate. Are those supermajorities?
Yes.
We heard that term a lot. What does that really mean?
Practically speaking, which I think is what matters and helps people understand things, is it means that the House and or the Senate could meet without any Democrat in the room. They could meet and conduct all their business without a single Democrat in the room if they wanted to. Now, that being said, they historically have not done that. Former House Speaker Brian Bosma made it a point not to do that and to include the minority party in discussions and debate. And I don't think there's any sign that that would happen going forward. But it means, you know, they don't need a single Democratic vote on any piece of legislation to pass.
Yeah, effectively speaking, how much power or influence do Democrats have in the budget writing and approval process?
They're involved in the process. You know, there are Democrats on the House Ways and Means Committee. There are Democrats on the Senate Appropriations Committee. And they will certainly have a say in things. They're certainly able to file amendments to get funding for various things that they want in the budget. And I think there are some negotiations that take place, but at the end of the day, Republicans are able to control what goes in the budget. And so if it's something Republicans don't want in the budget, then it's not going to end up there.
Now, a good deal of the session also will have to do with legislation. Can you give us just a quick rundown of the key issues you expect to be reporting on a lot?
So other than the budget, the one other thing that lawmakers have to do next year is redistricting. So they have to redraw the state legislative district lines and the congressional lines. That being said, it's unclear when they're going to get the population data from the Census Bureau, from the 2020 census. That is still up in the air, and they need that information before they can really start drilling down and figuring out how to redraw those lines. But that and the budget are the two things they have to do. And I think that's important to note. In normal legislative session years, we wouldn't be harping on that fact so much. But because there's so much unknown going into this session, they're really focusing on, okay, what do we have to do versus what do we want to do? But there are a variety of other things that I'm expecting lawmakers to be talking about, including tweaking what the governor is and is not allowed to do with his executive orders. I think some lawmakers have been upset about some of the things he's been able to do over the course of the pandemic without any lawmakers weighing in on that. Governor Holcomb has certainly talked to some of the legislative leaders over the course of all of this about his decisions, but there was never 150 lawmakers in the building taking a vote.
I've been really curious about this. Was there really an appetite for the legislature to come back into session so they could handle pandemic-related issues?
I don't think there was enough of an appetite. I think there were some lawmakers who wanted to see that happen, but I don't think it was a majority of lawmakers that wanted to see that happen. And Governor Holcomb himself has said that from who he spoke with, there was not an appetite for it.
I mean, in retrospect, they would have had to been continually in session. I mean, if they really wanted to be involved, I mean, these are decisions that are being made on almost a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely.
And or were they thinking like more big picture stuff?
I think one thing in particular they wanted to say in was how the state was spending its $2.4 billion. It received it from the CARES Act, which, you know, we've seen Governor Holcomb's administration just make decisions on over the course of the past few months. And we still have, last I checked, about $600 million left to allocate. That has to be allocated before the end of the year, but that's a different story.
Oh my goodness. They're going to be busy over the next 3 weeks.
Yeah. But back to the legislative session, aside from redistricting and Governor Holcomb's powers, the top priority for the business organizations in the state is going to be passing liability protections for businesses, meaning protecting companies from what they're calling frivolous COVID-related lawsuits. Not exactly sure what that's going to look like yet, but top lawmakers in both chambers have said it's going to be a priority for them. Heard earlier today, it might be one of the top two, if not the top two, Senate bills filed this year, and they always kind of reserve those top spots for their top priorities. Last year was healthcare-related legislation.
That same topic, the liability topic for businesses, has been one of the two or three main sticking points for federal aid. I mean, it seems like it always crops up and kind of throws a fly into the ointment whenever they get close to passing a federal aid package.
Yeah, I think that people in Indiana were hoping, or business leaders in Indiana were hoping, that Congress would have passed some sort of protection by now. You know, IBJ did a story in the summer that talked about this, and there, at that point, there really wasn't an appetite for the state lawmakers to take action on it because the thought was that Congress would. And now we've seen Congress has not acted on that. So business leaders are turning to our state lawmakers to do something about it.
Well, we're going to be sure to check in with you probably several times over the next few months. And as always, appreciate all your work.
Thank you.
My thanks again to Lindsay Aridone. If you'd like to read more about the issues driving the upcoming session, Lindsay has stories in the latest issue of IBJ that cover budget priorities and how lawmakers hope to protect themselves during the session. And before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to point out a couple other strong entries. The negotiations to relocate Elanco Animal Health's headquarters campus from Greenfield to downtown Indy were so high stakes and top secret that Indy and state officials needed to use code names to refer to them. IBJ's Mickey Shuey has a fascinating behind-the-scenes look at the negotiations, which included a huge incentives package for Elanco, competition from other cities, and an ungainly piece of property tied up in tense litigation between the city and a private developer. And John Russell explores how hospitals are discharging some patients earlier than they normally would have been in order to free up more beds during the pandemic. In some situations, they're going home with oxygen machines, intravenous lines, and powerful medicines. Again, you can see these stories in this week's print edition of IBJ, or of course, online at IBJ.com. I will say, it's quite a bit easier to access all the latest news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.